I'll call to order today's meeting for the Water Issues Committee. And today is Wednesday, May 14th. If you would please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance, I'll have Director Jung lead us.
Please rise, join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready, begin. I pledge allegiance to the
To the
flag
flag
of the
of the
United
United
States of
States of
America
America
and to the
and to the
Republic for
Republic
which it
for which it
stands,
stands,
one
one
nation,
nation,
under
under
God,
God,
indivisible, with
indivisible,
liberty
with
and
liberty and
justice for
justice for
all.
all.
Thank you. All right. Can I do a roll call, please?
Roll call, Director Green, Director Wigand,
Here.
Director Yeo,
Here.
Director Yeo,
I'm
Director
here.
Tran,
Present.
Director Nguyen, Director Omezcua,
Present.
Director Jung,
Present.
Director Meeks, Director Sheldon,
Here.
Director Bilodeau.
Bilodeau is here. I'm observing from Santa Ana. Thank you.
Thank you. You do have a quorum of your committee.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. Are there any items received too late to be agendized?
There are none.
Okay. Now is the time for visitor participation. Are there any visitors in the room that wish to speak? And are there any online? Seeing no hands, I will move on to the consent calendar, items number 1 through 12. Is there any directors who wish to pull any items or wish to make a motion?
Tran moved to approve.
Great, thank you. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
All right, perfect. Seeing no other hands, I will call for the roll.
Roll call, Director Wigand.
Yes.
Director Tran.
Yes.
Director Yeo.
Yes.
Director Mezcua.
Yes.
Director Jung.
Aye.
That motion carries 5-0.
Great, thank you. All right, now it's time for matters for consideration. Item number 13 is
You need a
award.
charger? I have one.
Award direct access electricity contract for groundwater replenishment system, Burris Pump Station, and Green Acres Project Santa Ana Reservoir. I had sent a note to our council about the fact that I have shares that I own of Royal Dutch Petroleum, which Shell Energy is involved with, but I don't have enough shares, I believe, that allows me to be disqualified for participating. So I just wanted to make that. I was close, but our council had written back saying that I was safe. So is there anything else I need to do, Jeremy?
No, you're good to go, Director Wigand. You've made a disclosure you weren't required to, but there's no obligation to recuse.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Okay, I'll have staff lead us with that, please.
Yeah, Director Wigand, I'll be giving a brief presentation on this item.
Okay.
All right, good afternoon. We're giving a brief presentation on our direct access electricity procurement and give a little bit of background about what direct access energy is and why we procure it that way, and a little bit of information about the companies that are proposing, and then we'll get to our recommendation at the end. So, direct access electricity procurement is something that the district's been involved in for over 10 years. We currently have a direct access electricity procurement contract with Constellation New Energy, and that's part of a 5-year agreement that expires on June 30th, 2025. When we get pricing from direct access providers, so this is to provide base electricity for our different facilities that are involved in the program. It's usually those prices are changing daily. It's a commodity market, so based on the day the pricing is sought, the pricing is unique to that day and it changes day to day. It typically doesn't change a lot, but there can be market conditions that change it along the way. And then even when a facility like ours or an entity like ours is in direct access electricity, we still have to pay a portion to Southern California Edison for distribution and transmission. And going back through 2024, that roughly cost us about 5 cents a kilowatt hour to pay Edison to transmit and distribute the power, because the power is still going through their transmission grid, even though it's being bought directly through a direct access electricity provider. And then direct access providers provide power from a variety of sources in a large portfolio that can be coal-fired, hydroelectric, nuclear, or renewable in various forms, geothermal, wind, solar. So they're just trying to procure as much energy as they can from various sources to provide the best pricing, or they can provide certain types of power depending on the end needs of the customer. People that have renewable goals or goals for greenhouse gas credits, they can specialize in different types of power to meet those obligations. So the three facilities that are involved in direct access electricity procurement currently is what we call our Kiwi substation, or the electricity that is provided to the entire Fountain Valley campus, which is the majority of our usage. So that includes the groundwater replenishment system, advanced water purification facility, our Green Acres treatment plant, which is also located on site. All of the buildings on the campus, including this one, are all powered through one substation in the back, and we've been buying direct access electricity through direct access since 2013. And all of our direct access procurement we've done over the years, we do use an advisor, Greg Allen from Aviva Energy. I should have started off with that. Greg's in the audience today. So Greg not only helps us, he helps OC San, and he helped get us into DA in the first place. So he's an expert on procuring power through DA and other sources. And then what we have in the city of Santa Ana is our Green Acres Project, Santa Ana Reservoir. So those that might not be familiar, our Green Acres Project, which provides non-potable water to our customers. We also have an off-site reservoir that we can use for peak flow demand. So it's a large reservoir that we bought from the city of Santa Ana, and it has a pumping station. And so it has a load that's somewhat intermittent compared to GWRS, but it can be high during the summertime when we have a lot of demand for non-potable water. And then one of our largest pump stations, besides those involved with the GWRS, is our Burris pump station in Anaheim. So Burris pump station is the main pumping station we use to transfer flows that we receive along the Santa Ana River to pump them over to our Santiago basins. We can also pump it to some of our smaller basins like Riverview, or we can also put some of that flow into Santiago Creek. So this pump station's critical, especially during storm events or when we have a lot of storm flow in the Santa Ana River, for giving us flexibility to transfer water to the Santiago basins to relieve some of the capacity along the Santa Ana River recharge system. And we recently got into direct access for that facility back in January. So that's the newest one. So there's several options to renew the existing direct access contract. Direct access offers power in a variety of pricing schemes. There's what they call load following, which is somewhat of a fixed price based on day-to-day market conditions of the following day. There's fixed block pricing, where you buy a certain amount of megawatts that you think you're going to use, and if you use more, you sell that back. If you use less, you buy what you need on the real-time market. There's obviously real-time market pricing, which at times can be advantageous, like when there's a glut of power during the day, like solar, but it can also be quite expensive when there's a shortage of power during like extreme heat events, grid emergencies. And then you can buy combinations of the three percentages of your power. And then there's different options for whether it's considered peak period, off-peak period, or if you want to buy one price that's around the clock. And then our current direct access contract kind of has a combination. It has a portion of the load that's got a fixed pricing and a portion that's on the real-time market. So, in order to renew the current contract, which is going to expire, we went out for an RFP on April 10th that the board approved, and we sent it to three firms that are the main players in direct access energy and that can provide the amount of power that we need for the three facilities. So, one is Constellation New Energy, who we currently have a contract with. NRG Direct Energy was the other, and Shell Energy. And so from these three firms in the RFP, we sought different pricing options: the load following, as I mentioned, the fixed block pricing, and then most importantly, which we haven't done in the past, which we think is going to be a key going forward, is having them fix the two largest fees, so to speak, that go along with the distribution of power, resource adequacy, and renewable portfolio standards. So those are two PUC-driven fees that even bundled Edison customers pay, but so do direct access customers pay. And those can be quite high during certain parts of the year. So we're seeking fixed pricing for both of those in this renewal of the contract. There's other fees that go along with it, like retail adder, and then you pay for line losses. So that's the loss of power as you transmit it along the grid. And then there's some metering pricing that goes in there too. So all of that is supposed to be accounted for in the pricing that these three firms will offer us. And so in order to determine where the market's at, we are requesting pricing from the three of these firms on a weekly basis and comparing them week to week to see how much they change. And then when we are ready for the final pricing, we can lock in a price and sign a contract. So for now, we've decided, because based on the pricing we've seen over the past few weeks, that it's advantageous for us to seek what we call a load following fixed price, so one fixed price for 5 years, and have the RA and RPS portions or those fees fixed as well, because we're seeing favorable pricing for all three to be at one fixed rate. So a little bit of background on some of these companies, the three that are proposing. The first one, Constellation New Energy, very large company. They've been providing our power, like I said, for the last almost 7 years. They do provide direct access also to Orange County Sanitation District. Based in the East Coast, they have a myriad of facilities. They can generate all the different types of power. You can see kind of the makeup there, nuclear, conventional, and renewables in terawatt hours. And they have quite a bit of customer load. You can see on the bottom middle, I know there's a lot of acronyms there, terawatt hours, 202 terawatt hours. And then they've been a very good supplier for us so far. We haven't had any issues, and they've offered a lot of good insight onto market pricing going forward. The other proposer is NRG, Direct Energy, based in Texas. You can see that they also have quite a bit of portfolio capability and experience both in natural gas and other types of procurement. The local customer that they provide that's most relevant to us, they do supply to a lot of water districts and other treatment plants, just like Constellation. But West Basin currently has a contract at their Edward C. Little facility with NRG Direct Energy. And then the third is Shell Energy. So Shell obviously is part of Royal Dutch Shell, the overall company. You can see on the right, there's a variety of California agencies that buy direct access power from them currently. And they have a large portfolio like the other two, and they have they provide power to various markets all around the U.S., just like the other two. So all three are very good liquid solvent companies that can provide the power that we need and offer competitive pricing. So these are the three that we're seeking pricing from. So as part of the weekly pricing, the latest pricing that we received, you can see here, was from May 13th. And we asked for the base five-year price, fixed price. We asked for the fixed resource adequacy, which is one of the key fees, reliable portfolio standards, and then also the other fees that are that I talked about, retail adder, congestion. And I just summarized them in one price here. And you could see that based on the pricing we received to date, somewhere around 9 cents a kilowatt hour, that they're all very, very close. So this will probably come down to the day that we're ready to sign the contract, which we're talking about being on May 22nd after the full board approval of this concept on the 21st. And so we wanted to bring to your attention that the pricing does change week to week because it's a commodity-based pricing that we're getting. So we don't expect these prices to change dramatically. If anything, hopefully they'll go down because they're very competitive, the three amongst the three proposers. So we'll see what the pricing we get, but this is about where we should end up. So this is a very good price for a 5 year. And then, of course, there is still the Edison fees that we would pay on top of this for transmission distribution, which averaged around 5 cents a kilowatt hour last year. So the recommendation today is, so this is a little different because of direct access power changes on day-to-day in terms of pricing. So our recommendation is to authorize a general manager in consultation with the board president to enter into a five-year contract ending June 30th, 2030 for direct access electricity procurement with Constellation New Energy, NRG Direct Energy, or Shell Energy. based upon the lowest pricing. For the OCWD, what we call our Kiwi substation, our Burris pump station, and our Green Acres Project Santa Ana Reservoir, and that would be based upon the pricing received on May 22nd, which is the first day after the full board approval of this recommendation. And with that, I can take any questions anyone may have.
Great, thank you. Very good presentation. Is there any of the directors that wish to have any questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, if you can go back to the final slide part of that, is that enough resource adequacy in your opinion that they are both all three vendors that they're, I suppose, offering slash proposing?
Yeah, so the resource adequacy is what they need to offer in terms to meet some of these PUC requirements to have additional capacity during grid emergency events. It's well defined, but it is an estimate on their part because it depends upon how much total power we consume or other customers consume. They have to hedge against what they think is the right amount. So you could see the variability there is, in my mind, kind of the risk one is willing to take versus the other based on all their other customers they have in their portfolio. So that's the one that can be variable amongst the amongst the proposers, just like RPS. But these prices being fixed at the way they are still quite good compared to what we've seen in the past few years under our existing contract, where they float along whatever the market rate is, and we didn't have them fixed.
So the market, in terms of RA, it was really volatile the last 3 years, and they project over the next three handful of years or whatnot that it'll stabilize. And in fact, what you said is go down?
Not really. Greg, you want to chime in on this one? RA, it's still pretty volatile, even going forward.
It is volatile. It's a good question. RA is a big topic right now because the regulatory concepts are changing, evolving. This year, they've switched from a capitalization on a monthly basis to an hourly basis. And so there's been a lot of question about what's the true price of RA going forward. Resource adequacy is basically a call that the retail providers have.
It's a hedge, right? And effectively.
They can buy it in the future. So the resource adequacy technically is for the suppliers, including Edison and PG&E and the other utilities. They call an option with the generators. So Edison will go out and say to a generator in Arizona, I want to make a contract where you're required to send us power this much for this period. And it's a bilateral contract. It is not posted. It's not subject to discovery. And so each one of the suppliers obviously has bought different pricing and different terms. Each supplier has to, it's a state requirement. They have to turn in reports annually about what percentage of their future load they have covered. And they take the projection and they have to gross it up by 16%. So every one of the suppliers has to have 116% of its estimated peak demand covered. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it's a statutory requirement. The contracts are bilateral and not subject to our review. And because there has been so much volatility in the market this year, if we were to buy a 1 year RA contract today, it would be probably closer to $30 or $40 per megawatt hour.
Right.
But over time, as the regulatory requirements are better understood or normalized, socialized, that price has come down.
All right. Very well. Thank you, sir.
Director Tran had his hand raised.
Yes, I do have a question. Other than prices, which seems to be very close, I wondered how are the response time or service availabilities for each one of these companies if there are issues or problems with the lines or the flow of wattage or whatever technical issues. What type of services and how quick or how efficient are they in responding to our needs?
Yes,
has that been taken into account?
Yes, sir. You asked specifically about delivery issues. That's handled by the utility. So as far as transmitting the power to our meter, Edison is responsible for that. These three suppliers provide only the commodity and the services, the RPS and RA that go behind it. So if we have a delivery problem or if it doesn't, if power doesn't show up, we call Edison. Typically, the service requests we have of the vendors are timely billing. Perhaps there's a discrepancy between what the RA provider, I'm sorry, the DA provider sent on their bill versus what Edison did. But they're very responsive. You are a big customer for them. This is a large contract, and we get good service from whichever supplier you select.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Great. Are there any other hands raised that I don't see? Okay, perfect.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, 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 Director Miller.
This is partially for Director Jung. Is there any role for the Orange County Power Authority in any of this?
Well, not currently, sir, because the Orange County Power Authority won't serve the city of Fountain Valley in terms of load-wise until north of 2026. So it'll be a while. But at the Power Authority, they're pretty well prepared regarding resource adequacy. But if our staff certainly wanted some, you know, verbal recommendations and something that wouldn't cost any, I would certainly recommend they put a call into the Power Authority. They are experts on the subject matter.
Okay. And I was just curious, when the Power Authority does serve Fountain Valley, would at that point, would we be looking at potentially joining the Power Authority? I just don't know how competitive they could be compared to these rates.
I would say that it's worth looking into, sir, but Energy, Shell, these are really large companies by comparison. So I don't know that Orange County Power Authority's current load could forecast anywhere near where they're at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all.
Thank you.
Great question and observation, Director Bilodeau. I think that's...
Any other...
Directors? Director Yoke.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Neho, can we go to slide number 8, the table comparing the cost? Are these truly apples to apples comparison, or different companies may have different levels of reliability issues? What I'm saying is, are we comparing the risks? Are they the same, similar, or because we're seems like the recommendation is at some point the end of the month we're going to make a decision, multi-million dollar decision, based on a number.
Yes, I mean, a big part of this RFP process and our work with Greg Allen is that they're all very reliable. They all can provide the power we need. They guarantee the pricing, and we vetted out all of the different, you know, extra wording or language in terms of exclusions or anything like that. So they all offer the exact same terms and conditions. So this is truly going to be coming down to price itself. And we've also vetted their long-term liquidity and financial status, but these are very large companies, so we're not worried about that. But yes, these are all apples to apples numbers, so it's really going to come down to the numbers itself.
Okay, great. And one follow-up question is, whenever there's like incentives offer, is it offered through Edison? Like, you know, from time to time we're asked to kind of dial down a little bit.
Yeah, so most incentives that we've participated in, including some design incentives during GWS, were directly through Southern California Edison. And then separately, when we participate in what we call demand response or voluntary load shedding, that's through a separate aggregator called NLX. But all the conditions and the calls for procuring or curtailing power come directly through Southern California Edison to NLX, and then they down to us to be prepared for a load shedding event.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Any other questions? Okay. I don't see any. Are there anyone? Is there anyone that wants to make a motion?
I'll move.
Okay, yeah. Director Young.
And I'll second the motion.
Great. Thank you, Director Yo. I'll call for the vote.
Roll call, Director Wiegand?
Yes.
Director Yo?
Yes.
Director Tran?
Yes.
Director Amezcua?
Yes.
Director Jung?
Aye.
That motion carries 5-0.
Okay. Moving on to item number 14, the results of the Riverbed Filtration System Demonstration Project and authorization to issue requests for proposals for feasibility study.
Yep, we'll have a presentation on this subject from Adam Hutchinson. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'd like to present to you the results of the what we call the Riverbed Filtration System Demonstration Project. This is a long-term project we've been working on for quite a while, so really happy to come to the board and share with you what we found and where we'd like to take this project going forward. So why are we doing this? Well, all of our recharge facility clog. You know, we divert a lot of Santa Ana River water into our recharge system, then we get tons of sediment. Fine-grained sediments, silt and clay that are floating in the Santa Ana River water, especially in the storm season. And that water gets into our recharge basin and they clog the recharge facilities. So it's really a primary constraint in terms of our ability to recharge water if clogging. So the question is, can we reduce clogging and thereby increase our recharge capacity? And this graphic here really illustrated what got our attention years ago when we started putting GWS water in the Miller Basin. And we saw the percolation rates really sustain themselves over a long period of time. So this graphic here shows the percolation rate in Miller Basin over time. The red line shows what happens with unfiltered Santa Ana River water. And you can see the percolation rate declined pretty rapidly. By contrast, the GWS water and imported water stays really high over time. And so if you look at those two at the same time frame, you're getting double the amount of water in the ground with imported water, GWS water, compared to raw Santa Ana River water. So that really shows you the benefit. If we can make Santa Ana River water better and cleaner, we could get a lot more water in the ground, just like we do with GWS water and imported water. So that led the district to do a large-scale recharge water sediment removal feasibility study. And what we did here is we took all the different engineering methods of treating water using chemical treatment, active flow, different technologies. And we said, let's try all of these side by side and see what we can do. And this is a large project. And we had the concrete test cells that are located out at the Forbay facility constructed to be able to mimic what would happen after this treated water is put onto natural sediments, because the water might look really clean, but when you put it on the dirt, what happened? And what we found surprised us. A lot of any method that used the chemical coagulant or flocculation sedimentation or different chemical treatment, when it hit the natural sediment, it actually caused clogging, even though the water looked clean. And this is because there were carryover chemicals in that water that interacted with the fine-grained sediments in the matrix, in the basin. And so what we ended up discovering was that the two methodologies we tested that used just purely mechanical filtration worked the best because there were no chemicals in the water. So riverbed filtration, which I'll talk about, and cloth filtration were both tested for further demonstration scale. The cloth filtration was found to be not cost effective because it was a limited in capacity and capabilities. So we're going to talk about riverbed filtration, which we pursued further after this study. So what is riverbed filtration? Well, it's kind of like a French drain that works in reverse. So French drains exfiltrate water into the ground. Riverbed filtration is just a series of PVC pipes laid about 3 feet below the surface, and it collects the water that's percolating down from the surface. But through the natural filtration properties of the riverbed sediments, the suspended solids that cause clogging are filtered out and removed. And this is really akin to what's been done for hundreds of years. It's called river bank filtration. It's done in Europe and all different parts of the world, where they actually put wells underneath the river channel and use the natural filtration properties of the river bed sediments to purify the water. And these wells here are used for potable use. So we're doing something similar, but we want to use that water for recharge purposes, which will eventually be used for potable use. And this schematic here is from Sonoma Water. They have 9 of these wells near the Russian River that they use for filtration and potable use. So we constructed a demonstration scale riverbed filtration system in the Off River Channel.
and it covers about 10 acres. You can see the orange, red boxes are showing where the areas where the subsurface laterals were constructed. Then we built a pipeline to carry that filtered water down to Olive Basin. It's a small little recharge basin, so that basin only gets filtered water now as a result of this project. Those laterals buried underneath the off-river channel are you built with two different types of materials. We have PVC pipe, really cheap pipe that's buried in a bed of gravel. But we also looked at rain tanks. These are like these collection tanks that are used for stormwater capture system. We wanted to see if there was any difference in cost and performance between the two. Turned out they ended up being about the same. So here's the picture of Olive Basin with the dedicated inflow meter. And this is the basin that's receiving the water from this system. So we've done 9 years of testing, so we've got a very robust data set as a result of this. This is really a group effort. I have to give credit to engineering for their support in designing the system, the laboratory doing all the water quality testing, Forbay staff for operating the system and doing a lot of the different combination of testing that we wanted to do, and then the field research lab staff as well. So really an all play in terms of district staff supporting this project. So really happy, thankful for their efforts. So what did we find? We found great results. The system removed 96% of the suspended sediments in the water. And this graphic here, the orange showed the raw water TSS, total suspended solids, and the blue is the resultant filtered TSS. And this is on a log scale, so it might be a little bit deceiving, but you're seeing more than an order of magnitude removal of suspended sediments consistently over time. So very performed very well, didn't show any sign of degradation over time. So what did that mean in terms of percolation rates? Sorry for the graph being kind of busy, but I'll try and walk you through it. The red line, as I showed before, the red line is the performance of Olive Basin with river water that's unfiltered. So over the course of time, this 500-day period shown in the graph, you're going to see a percolation decline. The basin needs to be taken out of service and clean 4 times over the course of this 500 days. Whereas the riverbed filtration water is shown on the other squiggly lines. And the reason they're not consistent is because the off-river channel is mainly for stormwater. And so in the summertime, when base flows are low, there's not enough water to supply Olive Basin. So we're really reliant on periods of time when there's excess water. So what we've done is kind of looked at the peak flows over time and how they've slowly declined. And that dashed line is kind of a projection of what would have happened if you had supply consistently to the basin. And what we see there, when you look at that projection versus the Santa Ana River water recharge, it's about double. So we kind of see the same thing at Miller Basin. We saw a doubling of the recharge capacity with imported and GWS water. We're seeing the same performance here in Olive Basin. So that gave us a lot of confidence that we're seeing something that's real, and that's something that's re reproducible in other facilities. So what do we do with this concept? Well, really what we want to do is get the biggest bang for our buck. And this graphic here kind of shows our recharge system and the way that it behaves in a different in different manners. So the blue, the Santa Ana River channel and associated basin, those basins get flowing water. The water's flowing, and so they don't really clog very much because that water's flowing, the suspended sediment doesn't have a way to settle out. Berth Basin and Santiago are shown in green. Those basins are primarily driven by elevation. So the higher the elevation, the more they recharge. But the purple basins I show on there, we call those terminal basins because those are basins where the water goes and stops. And like in a lake, you know, if you stop, everything's just going to settle out at the bottom. So the terminal basins are the ones that are most prone to clogging. Because once you put the dirty water in there, all that dirt just settles out in the bottom and creates the clogging layer. So that's really the target for this system. If we can get cleaner water into those basins, those will give it the best, biggest bang for our buck and give it the greatest improvement. And one thing I want to highlight too is the Warner Transmission Pipeline. This is the major pipeline that connects Warner Basin to Anaheim Lake and the other recharge basins shown here. And so if we start using purified water to feed those basins, that pipeline could potentially be a constraint and be a chokehold on the amount of water we can supply there. So that'll be something we want to look at closely. So the big idea here is right now we divert water from the river using our rubber dams, and they're great. They've really had a huge impact on our ability to divert water, and especially stormwater. But that water on the surface of the Santa Ana River, dirty, got a lot of sediment in it. And when we just recharge or divert that water, that dirty water goes to our recharge basin. So what if we could divert the water underneath the river using riverbed filtration? So now we're taking advantage of filtration properties of the riverbed, and that water we divert is filtered water. So instead of diverting on top, we're diverting below, but the same amount, trying to get the same amount of water over there to the recharge system. So we ran our recharge model that we have to see what would the potential benefit of doing this be. And so what we found using an 18-year period, historical data from 2003 to 2020, what would happen if we had a riverbed system? So if there's no riverbed filtration system, you can see here in the far left, recharge is in the order of 172,000 acre feet a year. And this is just stormwater and base flow only. Now, if you put in the riverbed system, there's an additional increase. And then if you increase the water transmission pipeline capacity, there's a further increase. And the right-hand panel kind of shows you the delta, the difference. So we're seeing if you had riverbed filtration, you could potentially get about 7,000 acre feet of additional water per year on average. Some years, dry years would be low, wet years would be high. If you could increase the water transmission pipeline, you could get upwards of 10,000 acre feet per year. So these are big numbers and very encouraging to see that there's a potential really big gain out there to be had. The problem is we don't know what the costs are going to be to build something like this. And that's really the genesis of what we're trying to talk, get at today is what is the cost side of the equation to do this? And before I go into what we want to do, I just want to mention that Turlock Irrigation District on the Tuolumne River has constructed something similar to this already. So this is not something new. This is something that other people have done. And they have this subsurface system here that can generate 100 CFS of flow from the Tuolumne River to divert environmental flows that have been released from a dam upstream. They want to re-divert that water back out and use it for irrigation and potable uses. So the technology is there, the know-how is there, just a matter of how would it apply to OCWD and our system here. So as I've shown, this system provides multiple benefits. It can potentially increase recharge. We've seen it in Olive Basin already, and that can reduce our amount of water we lose to the ocean, which is pretty valuable. The other thing this can do too is right now we in the wintertime we have sometimes conflict between GWS water and Santa Ana River water. But if we can filter the Santa Ana River water, we can blend it with the GWS water and not cause any clogging. They're going to coexist very nicely versus you divert dirty water into a basin with GWS water, you're not really benefiting from the purity of the GWS water. So that can increase both stormwater and GWS recharge during the wet years. And we can divert water when the rubber dams are deflated. Like right now, and over 1,000 CFS, the rubber dams have to be deflated, but that riverbed system can still divert water even if the rubber dams can't. So that's an additional benefit of having it. The cleaner water will also reduce the number of times you have to clean our recharge basin. They're cleaner, they'll run a lot longer, that'll reduce our O&M costs, reduce wear and tear on our equipment. So there's other benefits as well. So what we'd like to do is just do a preliminary feasibility study to just see if it's possible to build it in the Santa Ana River. Look at different locations, look at pumping system versus gravity, if they're a combination, looking at existing infrastructure such as the pipeline, if there's any value to upsizing those and what would it cost. And of course, we need to coordinate closely with the Corps of Engineers and OC Public Works to make sure that they're okay with the direction we're heading. And we want to develop a range of costs and really look at the cost benefits. We have the benefit side of the equation with the modeling, but we need to look at the cost side and see if this is worth pursuing further. So what we'd like to recommend is just doing a RFP for a feasibility study to look at the constructing this in the Santa Ana River and look at these other issues I just talked about. So Happy to take any questions.
Thank you for the
hard work on that. Very interesting. Seems very, very labor intensive. So appreciate that good report. And I failed to read on the subject that it says resilience plan priority project number 11 for OPWD.
Right.
So that's something we've planned out and we're looking forward in our future planning. So that's what this is coming to. So any directors with any questions? Okay. I think this is a great proposal and idea. I'll make the motion if anyone would like to second.
Second.
Okay. Any other directors? Seeing none? Okay, I'll call for the vote.
Roll call, Director Wigand.
Yes.
Director Yeo.
Yes.
Director Tran.
Yes.
Director Amezcua.
Yes.
Director Jung.
Aye.
That motion carries 5-0.
Okay. Perfect. All right. I will direct both of those items and the consent calendar to be on our consent calendar for the May 21st board meeting. Are there any directors' announcements or reports? Being none, is there a general manager's report?
Yes. The EPA excuse today about PFAS regulations. So,
Jason.
Yeah, I guess you know what that was. It just came out today. But,
great, timely. Go for it, Jason.
Yeah, thanks, Mehul. I just want to follow up on an email we sent to the board just before the meeting. This morning, EPA announced some major changes to the PFAS drinking water regulation they adopted last year, about a year ago. The highlights are that they're proposing to change the compliance deadline for PFOA and PFOS specifically. From the current 2029 period to 2031. So an additional 2 years of time for water systems to comply with that. The level is the same. It's the same four part per trillion level. That has not changed, but if the compliance timeline is proposed to be changed through future rulemaking that EPA would conduct. In terms of the other four PFAS that were included in the rule that were grouped in what was known as a hazard index, this is Gen X, PFNA, PFHXS and PFBS, EPA said they're going to rescind those and reconsider them, that part of the rule. And finally, EPA indicated that they will defend the current legal challenge to the PFOA and PFOS portion of the rule that was instigated by a couple of the National Water Associations back in DC that is currently still being litigated. But they indicated that they will work with the Department of Justice to defend that portion of the rule, but with the extended compliance timeline. So as Mehul mentioned, this just came out this morning. Staff and legal counsel are still kind of reviewing and digesting this and any impacts it may have on the district's treatment program. We've also reached out to state regulators in California, the Division of Drinking Water, see if we can get their initial reaction to that. I should have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow to speak with them and see how the state may react to this news. So just want to make the board and the committee aware of that. We anticipate providing a more complete update at a future board meeting once we know a little more. So that's it.
Okay, thanks, Jason. That was pretty timely. Any directors want to comment on that or any questions? Okay. Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned.
Okay.